Let it be known that British liberties are not the grants of princes or parliaments. That many of our rights are inherent and essential, agreed on as maxims and established as preliminaries even before Parliament existed. We have a right to them, derived from our Maker. Our forefathers have earned and bought liberty for us at the expense of their ease, their estates, their pleasures, and their blood. Liberty is not built on the doctrine that a few nobles have a right to inherit the earth. No! No! It stands on this principle that the meanest and lowest of the people are, by the unalterable, indefeasible laws of God and nature, as well entitled to the benefit of the air to breathe, light to see, food to eat, and clothes to wear as the nobles or the king. That is liberty. And liberty will reign in America.
And liberty shall reign in Canada and all over the world. That's from John Adams, the wonderful documentary. You should watch it. And welcome today to Radio Free Canada. I'm your host, Kevin Annett. We're here every Sunday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Central at the BBS Radio Network. CanadaRepublic.ca is our banner of liberty. And today we're going to be talking about the vision of Canada and how we work out from underneath the dead weight of the past and of corporate institutions that are criminal and murderous and yet are still in power. How do we displace them? How do we replace them? We're going to look into the history of our own struggle of how to do that and also ahead into the future, what we're building. And I'm going to insert today a new feature of the program. One of the things that it was suggested, actually, and I wanted to thank all you listeners for continuing to send in ideas for programs and questions you have about the show. One of the questions today was, can we talk more about what's going to go into our Constitution, which is going to be debated and adopted for the Republic at the end of October in Toronto? We're going to do that today in the latter half of the show. But as part of the introduction to this whole topic, I wanted to start a new little feature on the program, and we call it every week a moment from our hidden history. This moment is describing an event that took place in Winnipeg in 1919. We call it the People Take Over Winnipeg. From May 15th to June 26th, 1919, 30,000 workers in Winnipeg walked off the job to protest a lack of collective bargaining rights, poor working conditions, and low wages. They were soon joined by many hundreds of World War I veterans who demanded back pay owed them. Within a few days, the entire city was shut down and taken over. The authorities were helpless, and power had been taken over by an elected strike committee. This strike committee ran all of the food distribution in the city, set up its own civil courts, and created its own police force to keep the peace. Inspired by the strike, and this is the part I like, and facing daily hunger, groups of poor women in Winnipeg's North End took their own initiative. They formed action groups to seize food and other essential goods from the local stores, and they marked down the inflated prices to that which the people could afford to pay. These direct reclamations of life's essentials spread as North Enders began occupying empty buildings and distributing food and clothing freely to the poorest among them. On one occasion, when police showed up to protect a local merchant from these direct actions, a group of women seized the policemen, stripped them of their weapons and some of their clothing, and demanded that the police protect them from the gouging and greedy merchant. The police disappeared, some of them lacking their pants, as did the merchant. One Winnipeg newspaper declared, quote, "The ordinary immigrant and working man has lifted his head and stared down the face of constituted authority. They will brook no masters and have shown they are capable of ruling themselves without bosses or judges. The city is in their hands." Unquote. This growing tide of change continued only for a month. Eventually, the general strike leaders were all imprisoned and the daily demonstrations at Portage and Main stopped after the RCMP rode through the crowd and shot down strikers and their families. 30 people were wounded and 3 of them were killed by the Mounties, including a 9-year-old boy. but the example of a city being ruled by the ordinary people lingered on in many hearts and minds and gave birth to new movements for liberty across Canada, all during the 1920s and 30s. And that's today's moment from our hidden history. There'll be another one next week. Well, let me bring on my co-host, Ryan. Hello, Ryan. How are you this fine day?
I'm doing pretty good, Kevin, and I really enjoyed that story and that clip of John Adams at the beginning. I think that's a very essential point in understanding the problems that we face. And one of the points that you wanted to bring up about how these criminally convicted institutions can still operate as law. It just, for me, it makes sense, but for others out there, it might be kind of confusing even to think that how are they convicted in the first place? They don't know anything about the common law courts.
That's right. And, you know, it's kind of funny that there was somebody once said, some philosopher long ago said, people move into the future with their eyes on the past. And whenever people talk about change, they're always looking to the old models. I mean, time and again, every week I get emails from people saying, I've got a case I'm taking into the courts to fight, you know, for justice. Can you give me any advice? I said, my first advice is don't go into their courts. There's that inertia of the past, and it's a big thing to get out from under. But one of the ways we do it is through a vision. And by the way, it's not only summer solstice today, it's also Father's Day. And I wanted to thank my father, William Annett, for bringing me into the world, and which I guess was a fairly subversive act. But thank you, Dad. And we also want to thank our founding fathers of Republic of Canada, people like Louis Riel, Louis-Joseph Papineau, and William Lyon Mackenzie. And my great-great-great-grandfather, Philip Annett, who as a farmer near London, Ontario, Watford, Ontario, picked up his rifle and tried to overthrow the Tory clique running Upper Canada. Well, thank you, Philip, for bringing me here today. And for all of you, thank you again for tuning in. So, Ryan, I want to flag a few things, and Dan and Jonathan are supposed to be coming on as well. But one of the things that I hope we can discuss today is, you know, the power of a vision to replace an old system is very, very important, that you cannot imagine any kind of change without a vision and a model of what we're aiming for, not just what we're against, but what we're for. And that's what, you know, people who write into the show keep saying. Let's talk about the vision of Canada. The latter half of the show, we're going to kind of look at aspects of the proposed constitution. But what are your thoughts kind of on what's needed, perhaps even at an individual level, to kind of break the power, the psychological power the status quo has over people?
Well, I think two things come to mind. One is what I say every week, and that is education, specifically historical education about the past. And the other thing is I really honestly think time is important, because no matter how much information you give people, they kind of do look at the past as a model for the future. And obviously, if you continue to do things the way you've always done them, you're always going to get the results that you've always gotten. You have to change the way that you do things to get different results. So after people are informed of the way in which to change the world and the way in which to change the system they live in, because that is the point, you have to change the entire system. You cannot work within a system that is already broken to find some type of new result. Otherwise, your results will be broken too. You have to give people time, I think, Kevin. You have to put the information out there. And I think, you know, I personally have seen over the years, just in my 6 or 7 years involved in this, people beginning to come more to terms with information that has been readily available for however long. I mean, have you seen there kind of be an awakening more so? I don't like using that word, but kind of an awakening where information that is so blatant, so right there in your face, information that you uncovered about the residential schools, how even though that was there for so long in people's faces, they ignored it, and now more and more people are beginning to understand that what you said is true. They just needed time to come to terms with the realization that things are not as they seem. What do you think?
Well, exactly. And the other thing that was needed for kind of the so-called mainstream to get on board with recognizing that, yes, genocide occurred in Canada, is they needed Big Brother to tell them that it happened. They needed the government to come on and said, yes, genocide happened, and then everybody thinks it's legitimate. Because the parent figure tells them that it is. When we were proving it year after year after year, hard evidence convinced a certain minority, but the majority of people, even when they're looking at death records, even when they're watching eyewitness testimonies of children burying other children and all these horrendous crimes that are clearly genocide, it still didn't catch on because it hadn't had that stamp of legitimacy from the status quo. But unfortunately, all the status quo does when they stamp something legitimate is they control it and they allow it to carry on. And there's a little news item I wanted to share in that regard, which we can talk about. It comes out of Winnipeg as well. And it was shared with me, one of our members in Winnipeg is starting a whole campaign about this. This is what happens when this Truth and Reconciliation Commission is allowed to whitewash genocide in Canada. There was an article in the Winnipeg Free Press on May 17th about a man, a United Church minister called Robert Campbell. And he's the minister at Westminster United Church, right on downtown at St. Maryland and Westminster in downtown Winnipeg. And over a number of years, he was accused and it was proven that he had been molesting and harming young boys in the church. Well, things came to a head, and guess what happened? The police backed off and didn't investigate the guy at all, and the United Church did their own in-house inquiry into this fellow. And guess what the result was? He was put back in the pulpit. And what's really interesting about this, and so sickening, is this man is not only back in the pulpit, and he's a known child molester, but the entire church is behind him. And in those 90 days when he was asked to step aside while they were, quote, investigating him, guess how much money he was given? This is in the Winnipeg Free Press article. The church gave him $41,000 over a three-month period. Now, I was a United Church minister, and I sure as hell didn't make $41,000 in 3 months, let alone a year. This guy was given what clearly is payoff money to keep him quiet. And the reason he was, and this fits all the pattern, the police step back, the guy involved is paid off and to keep quiet about it, and the whole thing is whitewashed because it might point to other people in the system of child trafficking that the churches are so heavily involved in. So clearly he's
right, and he's allowed this.
Right. Go ahead.
Go ahead. He's allowed to stay in the system. He's allowed to stay in the system and continue the abuse.
Exactly right. This man is preaching at Westminster United Church. There's talk of, there is some grumbling in the congregation. Some people want him to step down, but it's only the individual congregational members. The presbytery, which is the body that hires and fires ministers, and the conference, Manitoba Conference of the United Church, are both backing this guy. Just like when I was fired, my congregation wanted me, but the Presbyterian Conference removed me after I'd started to expose these murders in the residential school. So, you know, it shows you this system, and whether it's the United Church, the Catholics, Anglicans, whoever, they get to get away with child molesting. They're protected by the police, and it carries on. So I just want to let people know that in Winnipeg, there's a movement starting. People are going to go, they're going to start picketing Westminster United Church, and they're going to start even considering issuing a citizen arrest warrant against Robert Campbell. Go in there on a Sunday and take the guy out in cuffs and remove him. Banish him from that church and community because he's a threat to the children of that community, and the Winnipeg police are colluding in helping this guy stay in his position. So that is Westminster United Church, 745 Westminster Avenue in Winnipeg. The number is 204-784-1330 if folks want to call up the church and complain. But over the next few weeks, there will be picketing going on at the church, and if you want to be involved in that, you can contact our Winnipeg branch through republicofcanada@gmail.com.
Well, Kevin, why do you think it is? We've seen so many cases all of the time. It's almost every week now, something in the mainstream media, a situation just like this where the priest is put back into the system, moved from location to location, allowed to continue abusing kids, even if they've been convicted of child pornography or abusing kids in the past. One case recently that Curtis Bottmeimer, who was convicted of 20 felony counts of molesting children and put right back into the system, and the church admitted that they protected him. Why is it that not only are priests allowed to continue that abuse in the system, but why is it that it's so hard, do you think, for people to come to terms with the reality of the situation when the abuse is so blatantly widespread and it's not just a couple of bad apples like they'd like you to believe?
Well, I want to answer that question, but I also want to bring in Jonathan and Dan. They're both online right now. Welcome, guys. Welcome to the show again.
Hey, thank you. I was thinking, Ryan, I think you could probably sum that up in two words, and that would be crimen solicitonis.
Yeah. Do you want to explain?
That's very true.
Yeah. That's the policy in the Catholic Church, which basically says, and it's in writing, It says when children are harmed, the priest, the victim is silenced and the police are not told. And if you squeal on the child rapist, you're excommunicated. Now, the Catholic Church is brazen about that, but the other churches don't publish their policy. They just act it out, but they all do the same thing.
Yeah, I think you could also add, to answer the rest of the question, you could also probably add unum sanctum in there, the notion that the church is above the law of God, basically, that the dominion, has dominion over the earth, the idea of the globus crucigor, which is the little tiny symbol you see with the earth dominated by a cross. The cross is dominion over the planet. The church has dominion over the earth. And that notion that these guys are somehow not only above God, but they are above all forms of laws, whether they are God-given laws or they are just innate human rights, that these people just can do whatever they want. It's a notion that a lot of people who look at this information, that they're so vehemently opposed to it because they think, that guy's a man of God. He wouldn't do something like that.
Well, that's the brainwashing kicking in. You know, Dan and Jonathan, you've been active in London confronting you know, the Anglican Church over their cover-up of their murder of Native kids at the Mohawk school. Any comments about that? I mean, you did have some experience, you know, approaching those church members. There is that standing arrest warrant out for Bishop Bob Bennett for his destruction of documents about the residential schools. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I think that the thing that we came across the most doing that those sort of actions is that the average parishioner of the church has absolutely no idea about the crimes that have been committed by the church, or that any of these people who run the church have been convicted in an international common law court of justice, then they're guilty for concealing genocide. None of the members of the church do that. The church does such a good job of hiding this information from the congregations, and the reason behind that is because if people don't show up in the church, then the churches aren't going to have any money to run the show anymore, right?
Exactly.
Right. I mean, do you think that's one of the main reasons why people continue to treat these convicted bodies as being legitimate?
I would have to say that more than anything, I think that ignorance plays the largest role in the whole situation, for sure.
Yeah, there's that funny double thing, too. My old aunt in Edmonton, she was a big backer of mine. She loved the work I was doing. She thought what the United Church had done to me was terrible, but she was a loyal church member, and every week she'd go to church, put her money in the collection plate, pay for the lawyers who are covering up these crimes, pay for these child rapists, you know, to get away with it, and yet she had that double think. She supported the work I did, and yet she also supported the church, because I guess in her mind, what she was doing on Sunday didn't have anything to do with little children being killed and thrown on the ground. You know, it's that split thinking that's part of the problem, too.
So what's one of the best ways to make that realization, or to get people to understand that there's a major difference between, I guess you could say, the proverbial work of God and what these corrupt institutions do in the name of God? How do we make the difference between the two?
Well, I've got a very strong opinion about that. Let me ask Jonathan or Dan if they want to comment first.
Jonathan, you go ahead.
I think for on that topic, really just comes down to the individual. They really need to understand, again, who they are in themselves, right? If they can really understand that they have that same God-given spirit within themselves, and they don't really have to find that within the church. I think that's what the real, I guess, awakening, if you want to use that word, would have to come to, is you just have to realize who you are so that you don't... I feel like a lot of people always go to the church just for that communion in spirit, right? So I just kind of feel like that's what they would need, is awakening and just understanding and who they really truthfully are.
What do you think, Dan?
I think that mostly it's just an awakening. People need to open their eyes and see the crimes that are being committed around them, right? So many people are in such a deep slumber nowadays, and more people are waking up, and it's good to see that. That's how movements such as ours come about, The Republic as well, but it needs to start happening on a much larger scale. Like, we need to be taking it upon ourselves to try and tell at least two different random people. It might not be someone that you know. It might be someone you bump into the grocery store. Everybody needs to start spreading the word and telling these truths every day. Because, you know, even if you can plant a seed, that seed can grow and these people can learn this information on their own. You can't explain everything to them in a quick encounter, but you can plant a seed. And if they nourish that seed and they water it with knowledge, they're going to grow into a completely different person. So I think it's very important just to spread knowledge.
It's really interesting because I agree completely with what the two of you are saying, that's good and necessary. But we find that effort reaches less than 10%, that 90% of people need to be forced to believe something. And by force, I don't mean going up and holding a gun to their head. They go with the wind. And there's a very famous saying from Machiavelli. Now, I know people say Machiavelli is a terrible guy. He was, you know, this Machiavellian is a bad word, right? It means some kind of amoral conspirator. But Machiavelli made a very important point in his book, The Prince. He said, the majority of people have to be forced to believe something. They do not come to it of their own free will. They must be forced. Now, that was kind of repugnant to me when I first heard it. But in reality, when we look at what happens, that's exactly true and accurate. That the majority of the people in that Anglican church, if they feel they're going to lose something, will start thinking something different. And here's the proof. The churches of Canada did not start issuing apologies or talk of money to their victims until they were threatened with a lawsuit. Actually, the first lawsuit that I was involved with in British Columbia back in 1998, it let the churches know that you are going to lose money if you don't start forking over the truth. And there's an old saying from Jimmy Hoffa, the Teamster leader. He said in negotiating with anybody, once you have them by their balls, their hearts and minds always follow. And that's the point. In order to get people to switch allegiance, you've got to get them, quote, by their balls. They've got to go after something that they think they're going to lose. And that is when people's eye start changing allegiance. So it isn't just moral appeals. That works to a certain degree. But what really changes things is when we are threatening their system. And look at another example of that. We started occupying churches in Vancouver. The lawyers went ballistic. I was getting calls from the Archdiocese lawyers pleading for us to stop occupying the churches at Easter. Guess what happens within a month? The TRC is announced in Ottawa and the apology. None of that is accidental, you know. And so we've got to know where to get them and apply pressure. And that's one of our strongest weapons.
That's right. Even after the convictions in 2013, the Pope Ratzinger stepping down, Adolfo Pachon stepping down, different archbishops stepping down from their positions. Even the current Pope Francis has been speaking about in the last year of retiring and stepping down early from the papal seat. So, you know, obviously there doesn't seem to be a direct correlation in, say, the mainstream media or in the public's perception of the work that we're doing as opposed to the reaction that we're getting from these institutions. But there is a direct connection, which is why they run so much much deflection in terms of the TRC.
Well, exactly. And, you know, I can guarantee that if a group of people got together in Winnipeg and started occupying Westminster United Church on a Sunday and confronting this Robert Campbell, he would step down. Whereas you can hand out all the leaflets in the world and make moral appeals to them, it's not going to change anything by itself, but it's a necessary part of the whole thing. So I want to just throw that out there because I know a lot of our members are listening and kind of thinking this stuff over. Go ahead.
Yeah, I would definitely have to agree with you on that one, Kevin. I had said that before when we were speaking previously that going and actually performing one of these actions is worth more than 1,000 hours of me standing on the street corner handing out leaflets and approaching random people and trying to plant that seed. Actually seeing something being done and being able to see that citizens are able to take back their power and correct a wrong that has been made by one of these institutions that think that they're above the law goes a lot further in garnering more support for our movement. I would have to agree with that 100%.
Yeah, no, that's why it kind of leads into another topic. Kind of the next step in this whole thing is taking action under the jurisdiction of the Republic, the Common Law Republic. Since January 15th, for new listeners, we have been operating under a different jurisdiction in Canada. And under that jurisdiction, we are in the process of training common law sheriffs. Now, these sheriffs are the frontline officers of the new Republic, and they establish citizens' militias, they deputize police to take action like what we're talking about. So the sheriff training program is really vital right now, and I want to alert everybody to the sheriff training manual that's posted at kanatarepublic.ca. We have more requests all the time to get this into the hands of people who want to get on board. So that's a real priority, setting up these workshops for training the sheriffs, and I wanted to just remind people of that.
But Kevin, I wanted to ask you about a lot of these corporations, the church, these convicted dead bodies, how do they have so much power over the people? And if they don't actually have power, how do they maintain that perception of power?
Well, and, you know, Dan and John, Jonathan, you can jump in at any point, but you know, my whole take on this is that you look at the origin of the word corporation. It comes from corpus, of course, which is the same root as the word corpse or body. A corporation is a dead thing. It was actually the first corporation in history was the Church of Rome, created in Rome in 317 AD. It replaced the Christian church and set up this new corporate body. In a corporate structure, there's nobody actually in charge. It's a self-regulating dead object. And when people, and there's, it's really interesting when you look at, because a lot of our legal understanding comes from the Bible originally. And in the Bible, the word for, in Hebrew, the word for corpse is the same as for idol, I-D-O-L. It's something living that's an idolatry, something that isn't living, that's idolatrous and destroys the living. It, this is kind of the understanding that when you worship a dead idol, and, you know, all throughout the Old Testament, the biggest, you know, when the way they portray God, God freaks out the most when the people of Israel are worshiping these dead idols. Because basically he's saying to the people, it'll cost you your soul. And that's exactly what we find in, when you look at the people involved in corporate institutions, they don't seem to have a functioning soul. They've surrendered that to the corporate body. That's why we need to decorporatize the system. And it starts at, as you know, we're all saying today, at the individual level, but it also has to manifest in another system to replace that. Like in the third stage of an exorcism, the first stage is you name the entity and expose it. You take away its power by naming it. The second stage is you expel it from the body, which is basically what we're doing. And the third stage is you replace it with something else, a new spirit. And that happens on many different levels. So I think that that's part of the explanation behind the scenes of what why that is.
Well, in that case, how do we get people to kind of turn their attention towards alternative bodies? What's the main thing that we can do to bring attention to the common law courts and to help people to understand that they have the right and the ability to establish these courts in their own communities?
We do it. We establish it. We just do it. And we show people that it can work, that it's a model that can work. What do you guys think?
Well, I would definitely have to agree. Throughout history, any new system of rule that has ever come about has simply been legitimate because enough people have signed on to it and said that it's legitimate. All it takes is enough citizens standing together and fighting as one to take on the government and to create a new system, a new paradigm within our country, to create our own republic without ties to the monarchy. It just takes everybody standing together and working together. And when enough of us say that it's so, it will be. That's basically my look at it.
Yep.
Yeah, I'd agree 100%.
Yeah, so that's always the, you know, the old tale of the mice all want to get together and put the bell on the cat, and they all talk about it and debate it for a long time, and then somebody says, yeah, but who's going to do it? Who's going to actually risk getting eaten to go hang the bell on the cat so we know when he's coming? That's what we're finding now. People like Dean Clifford, like Steve Finney and Kitchener, the people who go toe-to-toe with the system now, not surprisingly, the system makes an example of them and bashes them down and locks them away and say, this is what's going to happen to you if you try it. But if you get 10 people in a courtroom doing it, even 5 instead of 1, you will notice how the whole energy changes because suddenly we're a body and there's strength there, you know, and that's why we've got to get these courts operating. Dan, I know one of the things we've been talking about over the last couple of weeks is one of the campaigns within the Republic now, there's kind of two of them and they're both connected. One, exposing child trafficking in the children's aid systems. And the second is the tax fraud and financial fraud going on across this country. And there's a move now, we even have a working group of a number of people who are putting together a case against the Canada Revenue Agency. And I wonder if you want to talk about, you know, your thoughts about that at all and maybe how it connects to this.
Well, I think right now would be a perfect opportunity to let people know that we are working on this case and we are underway with it now. And we need anybody who is listening tonight that has had any complications with the CRA or any dealings with them, if they've been victimized by the CRA, to contact us so that we can use them as a plaintiff in the case. We need as many plaintiffs and as many witnesses as possible to build a case against the church. So if anybody listening knows of anybody who has been victimized by the CRA, we would like them to get into contact with us. I'm just going to give it an email address where people can come in contact with us. They can either email the Republic of Kanata at gmail.com, or they can email myself at LondonDirectActionGroup@gmail.com as well. And we can get them set up to help us out and get working together with as many Republicans as possible to bring this case to fruition.
Right, and there's actually a group, we were having a conference call, and we're going to have another one right after the show with the same people. There's a group in Ottawa that's really done a lot of work already in exposing the CRA, showing that how it's a private offshore corporation with no jurisdiction over any citizen in this land, the land of Kanata. They don't even have jurisdiction over the legal straw man that are often cited in courts. So this is very important to know. This is a foreign body like the Crown itself that's sucking the money out of the country and taking it God knows where. So that's part of the research we're going to come up with, which we need for our statement of claim in the court case. Now, we're going to also be serving subpoenas on the head officers of these corporations, don't forget. And there's a great theater element in these court cases. We're going to be going into the offices, government offices, and serving these subpoenas on people and filming them and making this a whole media event. So we need everybody's involvement in this. If you can operate a camera, if you can bring down the troops to help out with this, please contact us. And Dan's doing a great job in organizing that, so please contact him. Jonathan, Ryan, any thoughts on that?
No, yeah, I just wanted to make a comment.
Just contact Dan.
Yeah. Go ahead, Ryan.
Oh, go ahead. Yes. I think there was a delay there on the phone. Go ahead.
I think he said he agreed with Dan, but go ahead. Yeah, say what you want.
Okay, I was going to just bring up what you had talked to me about before we started talking about the show, and something else that I wanted to talk about was the proposed constitution for Kanata, and I wanted to see what your thoughts were on that. We haven't talked about that much on the show.
Well, yeah, it's actually the bottom of the hour, and I'm glad you asked that, because we have up online at kanatarepublic.ca. The part of the vision for Kanata is a proposed constitution. It's the legal basis of the new nation, but it's also the vision of what Canada's about. And people can go to that and read it. It's a proposed constitution. There's amendments coming to it. It's being debated right across the country right now. And it's going to be formally adopted, like I said, at the Constitutional Convention in Toronto between October 30th and November 1st of this year. Now, if you're a sworn citizen of the Republic, you have full voice and vote at this convention. It's an open delegate system, so anybody can come who's a sworn citizen. And if you're not, you can come as an observer without voice and vote. We're also going to have it live streamed. We've got a commitment of a group to do that for us, and this will be seen all over the world. Here's a few things I wanted to, and let's have a group discussion about this. There's a few items in the proposed constitution that bear directly on what we're talking about. It's proposed in the constitution. First of all, you know, the first articles have to do with the nullification of the power of the Crown, the Vatican, Canada, the abolition of the Governor General, and every oath of allegiance to the Queen. These are, you know, kind of standard legal things we've got to do. And establishing the supremacy of the Republic. Now, the next two, Articles 7 and 8, are very interesting because they deal with Indigenous sovereignty and the sovereignty of the Quebec people. And it basically says neither an Indigenous nation nor Quebec has to be part of Kanata if by a majority vote they want to secede. But we really urge them to stay in economic and political partnership and union with Kanata. And basically because the resources and the wealth of Canada and Kanata are huge and they have to be defended together. So we're looking at a federation of different nations, really. The Indigenous nations, Quebec, the English-speaking nation, and others. I want to flag that because people in Quebec have been asking about that. We've got actually a very vibrant movement starting in Quebec because they're already down the road on this. They've been fighting for sovereignty from the crown for many years. At least 40% of their population wants sovereignty right away. The other thing I want to flag that we can talk about is these following benefits that derive from the New Republic. The New Republic under Articles, just let me get it, Article 17, public nature and ownership of finances. Now, let me run this out and we can talk about it. All of the money supply, banks, credit, and financial institutions shall be nationalized and are established as publicly owned services under the control and direction of the state and the local community. And here's the part. All banking debts, interest rates, and mortgages are canceled, and a general moratorium is declared on all personal and private debts, and income tax is abolished. Now, that's let's talk about that because that's aimed directly at the financial oligarchs who are running the country and the mortgage stranglehold they keep over people. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, that is one of the big, big issues that few people know about, regardless of where they stand in terms of some of the content that we discuss on this show or other shows like my show, The Secret Teachings. They tend not to know much about banks because most people, I feel like, think, well, we need banks. It's the kind of idea that we've had bred into it, that banks are a necessary component of our culture. If you go back into the history of banking, I mean, I could give you a couple examples of the different wars that have been waged, the proxy wars that have been waged in Iraq, Afghanistan, in different parts of the Middle East. A lot of those countries did not have a central bank until a joint force of the British and the Americans went into that country and supposedly liberated it, therefore establishing a centralized bank and putting all these people in this country into a massive amount of debt. And debt is a way in which you can control people very easily. So you make up this money that does not exist, never existed, never will exist, charge people interest on money that doesn't exist, and then when they can't pay it back, you're able to go in and legally, not lawfully, but legally, take physical assets that have some type of intrinsic value. So it's a legalized form of tricking people into giving up actual assets for fake money, and we don't actually need these banks. It's funny that if you go back into the history of the American Revolution, fighting for independence, people like Benjamin Franklin, something you never hear about in history books anywhere, says that the main cause of the revolution had to do with the outlawing of private interest-free currency called colonial scrip that the colonies had printed in order to step away from the centralized loaning of money to the Central Bank of London. So that's a very, very important thing to understand.
That's really interesting.
And as a matter of fact, on that point, Andrew Jackson in the 1830s, Andrew Jackson was the first president to have an assassin come after him, and it was just a couple of weeks, I believe, after he gave his famous speech in Congress, speaking directly to the bankers who were looking for a charter to extend the central bank in the country, and he told them no, and he famously said that I will weed you out like the den of vipers that you are. And it wasn't just a couple of weeks after that an assassin came at him with a gun. His gun misfired, and Jackson chased him down, and I guess they caught the guy and beat the hell out of him. But that was the first assassination attempt. The second one was on Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War there in the late 1800s, and the primary cause of the Civil War in America was because the Rothschild dynasty operated out of Britain and out of other parts of Europe, wanted to loan the United States money, same British Empire that we had fought to escape from. And when Lincoln refused to take that money because he had printed what we called greenbacks, currency that was printed in green ink on the backside of it. It was interest-free like colonial scrip. And as soon as he refused that, that's when the Civil War started and Lincoln was later assassinated. So huge, huge ties in with the big banks.
Yeah, and they conveniently assassinated John Wilkes Booth, the supposed assassin, in a barn so he couldn't talk about what happened, right? It's always handy.
That's right. And, you know, he was actually involved in not that this has anything to do with it because people don't understand the history of Masonry, but he was involved in a Freemasonic lodge which was directly funded and connected to London bankers, as a matter of fact.
I heard he had a Jesuit confessor, too. Was that accurate?
Yes, actually, you mentioned that to me one time. I looked into that. That is true. That is true. And, of course, if you look into the history of banking, you look into people like William McKinley, You look into people like John F. Kennedy, the very famous one, Charles T. McFadden. All of these people stood up against banking, and they were either shot or they were, in McFadden's case, he was poisoned just a couple of days after standing up against the bankers in Congress and trying to overrule them, and he ends up being poisoned a couple of days later. So, I mean, there's a huge connection with all this. As a matter of fact, in terms of centralized banking being established around the world as a way to create all of this debt and to keep people in a state of servitude, of course, you have the IRS, the Canada Revenue Services, all of these different offshore corporations. And, you know, it's obviously something that's taught about the schools, so you typically think, oh, it's a conspiracy. You don't know what you're talking about. Well, if you look into the history of it, I mean, there's a very clear picture painted when you start connecting the dots and you see in the pattern of different people in positions of power that have the right and responsibility to make a difference and to weed out those quote-unquote vipers in society. And then what you see happening is every one of them, right down the line, anybody who opposes the system is either assassinated or attempted assassination or they're poisoned. I mean, to me, that pattern suggests that there obviously is some type of connection, and that shows you the power of these entities, which goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning of the show, Kevin, and that is these people act in aggression. They act outside of the perceived laws that the rest of us follow as law-abiding citizens. They right. act in not only an aggressive way, but a violent way, which I think is one of the reasons people are scared to talk about it, and it is subconsciously conditioned to believe that if I talk about that, I might end up in that same position. I might as well just sit back, watch TV, and not worry about what's going on in the world. But I don't know what your thoughts are on that. I know that's a lot of information.
Well, Dan and John, let me ask you if you have anything to say first about any of that. The Constitution or this idea of abolishing income tax, which of course is a very popular proposal for a lot of people.
Yeah, I guess for me, I think that right now it's just we all need to work together to make that a reality. The only thing that allows, there's no book, there's no law on the books that states that the CRA is allowed to collect income tax off of you. We simply allow them. So people need to learn how to take their consent back from that and how to know what their rights are under natural law and who they are as a person. So that they don't allow to be victimized by these people anymore.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting because I was on, and I should flag for people, next week where one of our guests is going to be Kevin Edwards, who founded the Wales Common Law Court. And he's been very active in using the court to go up against police and court brutality, Crown Courts in England. And so he's going to be our guest next week. But one of the things that when I was on Freedom Talk Radio, I am kind of a participant on that show out of England every Saturday. And on Freedom Talk Radio yesterday, they were talking about how corporate tyranny has taken over everything in England, including the courts, which are all becoming privatized. And the flags, as in Canada, you might notice if you're in a Canadian court, they often don't have flags anymore, just the symbol of the City of London Corporation. These are private commercial courts now. They're not even bona fide de jure courts. Courts of record anymore, which is why we can ignore them. That's the point. Corporate entities have no contract with us. We have no allegiance to them. We can ignore them, whether it's privatized police, privatized courts, whatever. And what the folks on Freedom Talk Radio were saying yesterday is all of the stuff we're seeing in society, whether it's increasing surveillance, police state tactics, police attacking you without warrants, taking your children and trafficking them, the rampant unaccountability and brutality of the system, it all comes back to something that started about 20 years ago. And this was this massive privatization program where normally accountable agencies, public agencies, were turned over to private interests. So then now it's so absurd that when I got deported from England in 2011, it wasn't even the British Border Agency doing it. It was a private corporation called Reliance Limited that makes money for everyone they deport from England. And so shows you that we have to attack this corporatization of society at its roots because it's the source of so many of this growing tyranny all over our nations. And that's one of the things we're going to talk about next week with Kevin. And it really relates to this whole discussion right here.
Well, I mean, that's the same thing with the kidnapping of children. A lot of cases historically, whether it's in Spain or Argentina, or even in different parts of Europe, occupied Europe run by the Nazis, and even in America, kidnapping of children to reteach them to be subservient to the state, just like Byzantine kings did as right. well. But what you see on top of that is that you have a lot of these child trafficking networks are involved with the corporations, are involved with the drug networks, are involved with the prison system, and it all ties into kind of a large, intricate web. And when you have whether it's Child Protective Services in Canada or the United States taking children from parents who, regardless of what the situation is, whether it's justified or not, you find that obviously they are, as well as the state, is being paid hundreds of thousands of dollars by the federal government to take those children in the first place. So just like you said, these people are making money extraditing people to London. Same things with the trafficking of children. They're making money by taking these kids. I mean, it all has to do with that kind of a corporate influence, though, I think.
Right. That's the source of so much of this. And Dan, in terms of the case with CRA, you know, the people who have worked for CRA have told us, some of our sources have told us, that there's even directives that go out from the head office to revenue agents saying, even if you have to defraud and issue false statements to get money off people, that you'll be able to do that. So they're telling their employees they can break the law and defraud people just to get money off them. Now, this is the same mentality at work, whether it's trafficking children or whatever. People are cattle that are being milked and then slaughtered. Literally, it's as if everybody's in a pen, and they call that the law and government, but it isn't. It's private interest with a government mask on it. And this is the whole notion of Canada. We are decorporatizing the system and taking it back.
That's exactly right. And you made a really interesting comment earlier in the show, something that I talked about individually, something that you and I have both talked about on this show before. And that is, people are, and this isn't just about child trafficking or the understanding of these dead corporations or the common law courts. It's all across the board. Doesn't matter if it's food additives, banking, doesn't matter. Is that people are so waiting for the authority figure, for the father figure, to make a decision for them and tell them that's what's going on, that when they hear other people talking about it, doesn't right. matter if you have evidence to back up what you're saying. They're waiting for the TRC to tell them this yeah. is what happened. Those other people, they're wrong.
Well, that's right. And you know, how many times, and Dan and Jonathan, you get this all the time, I'm sure, people, the first thing they'll often say when you hand them this information is, are we allowed to do this? Am I going to get in trouble if I do this? That's the little kid who's been hit too many times. That's how they think. What, you know, you get that experience?
Well, most definitely. Really. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, like, for me, it hasn't really been so much just, like, the leafleting. When I'm actually, like, at work and driving customers around, I'll just, you know, happily inform them about what's happened in their country and everything and just kind of what we need to do. And they'll, like, they'll just sort of ask, like, well, we need to take back our country. And I always get that exact thing, like, well, how do we do that? What do we do? How do we stand up? And it just sort of seems like everyone's just fearful to lose whatever that they do have. So I just mean, I don't know, I think it kind of is. We just have to start taking our own action just to show and lead the way yeah. that there is another possibility.
Yeah, exactly. Dan, you had something?
Well, for me, it's most people don't realize that the way the whole system is set up is that it's castrated everybody of their power. People don't have individual power, individual sovereignty anymore. Well, they do. They just don't think they do. They've been tricked and deceived into thinking that they have to submit to the system. It's like right. you were talking about with the courtrooms earlier. Everyone knows when you walk into a courtroom that there's a list of rules on the wall, and everybody needs to obey the rules of the courtroom. But what they don't let you know is that those rules only apply to people who have sworn an oath of allegiance to the crown. So they apply right. to the lawyer, they apply to the judge, they apply to the crown attorney, and every other person in the courtroom who's sworn allegiance to the queen. But by joining the republic, you have taken back that allegiance, and you are no longer standing under the allegiance of the queen. So those rules in that courtroom do not apply to you one little bit.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
they try to trick you into accepting their jurisdiction, but they have no jurisdiction over us anymore whatsoever. Their power is moot. They have nothing. We just need to not even recognize them at all anymore. They are illegitimate and have no dealings with them.
That's right. And, you know, if that's exactly it. And A, don't go into the courts, but B, if you have to go into the court, then get up and say that you have no jurisdiction over me, I don't recognize your authority, and walk out. You know, that that the more we do that, as a matter of fact, we had that experience when I was first talking to Steve Finney in Kitchener. He used to do that at first, and after a while, the judges started listening. And one judge eventually agreed with him that the Crown had no authority over him. He actually admitted that in a court. And we even got a letter. One of the native chiefs on the West Coast wrote to the Privy Council in London. This was 3 years ago now. Actually, 2011, 4 years ago. They were concerned about their fishing rights off the West Coast, and they did the traditional thing of, you know, writing to the Great White Mother in London trying to get her help. The Privy Council, I've got a copy of this email they wrote back. She said, the Privy Council office has no jurisdiction in Canada. This was 4 years ago. Well, guys, wake up call. Wake up call. There's a vacuum here, people. We got to fill it. That's great.
Well, Kevin, as we come up on the last couple of minutes here, everything we've talked about so far in today's show, whether it's about how criminally convicted institutions operate as lawful bodies and how they promote this image that they should still be treated as legitimate and as real, as people continue to give up their notion of sovereignty and be complacent in these situations and be compliant to these institutions and the Crown. And, you know, over the years, you've done so much extensive research and so much work in this field. What have you really uncovered that can kind of answer these questions better or put all of this in perspective for us?
Well, you know, that would take a whole show or several shows to systematically go through everything that we've uncovered over 20 years. But it comes down, three simple documents. And I wanted to actually flag that before we leave. I found in the course of a year, right in the archives at the University of British Columbia, three documents. And it convicted Canada. This is what led to the TRC, these three documents, because we introduced this in the first court case against the United Church and the federal government, and it brought in what's called the Brenner decision in the Supreme Court in British Columbia that said, yes, the churches and government of Canada are liable for these damages. First document was the application for admission form, where every native child had to be, their guardianship was signed over to the principal. So the state and the church were the legal guardian of the children, first of all, so they were guilty. Second was the Sterilization Acts, which allowed the government and the churches to legally sterilize, that is, commit genocide on any native person they wanted. And the third was the simple enormous death rate of 50%. Now, you'll notice nobody in the mainstream, so-called mainstream, in the universities, in parliament, will ever address any of those three documents, even though those were the ones we put out there year after year after year, because it proves intent to commit genocide. Once that's acknowledged, the system is null and void, as Dan said. It has no, even if it did have authority over us, which it never did, it doesn't now because of those crimes. So, you know, it's really that simple, and we have to keep hammering that home to people. And again, this stuff is all up online, itccs.org. So I want to, maybe that's a good note to end on leading up to next week. We're going to be carrying this on more. We're also going to have Kevin Edwards from the Common Law Court in England. Actually, it's the Common Law Court of Wales, talking about how they've been using common law to undermine Crown Court decisions in England. And there's a similar movement for a republic in England developing. We're going to talk about that next week as well. Just a couple of things. Go ahead.
Yeah, I had another question I wanted to ask you. Do you think that before people can make the decision to act on the information that we've given them, to act on the information that they have, do you think that there needs to be some type of inner spiritual awakening, maybe not spiritual, but some type of inner awakening to realize what's going on, or does something need to kind of directly happen to them as a person? What do you think about that?
Well, I think it helps, but I don't believe in linear phenomena. I don't think we have to, A, get awakened, and then, B, act. I think it all happens simultaneously. I often find people, once they act, they're out there taking action. And like Dan said, one moment of experience on an occupation is worth 1,000 hours of argument. I think we can get awakened in the course of acting, and we can act in the course of getting awakened. I think they go hand in hand. But we've got to be talking about both all at the same time, because these psychological and etheric shutdown mechanisms in us prevent us from taking action. And we've got to liberate our mind. You know, that I love that line in the movie Platoon, where the black soldier says, free your mind, your ass will follow. And, you know, we got to free our minds, people, but we do it through action, not just talk. So that's kind of my take. Any final words, Dan or Jonathan? Good. Well, I always...
No, not...
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
No, I just want to say not too much. I just definitely agree there. I think, like, you do have to have that some type of mental awakening, but that may happen in some case where the person may be down in their luck and they just may realize that this system isn't working for you. So, like you said, like, it really can come in more of a circular type of action, not so much linear. So you may really have some type of spiritual awakening then come here, or like you said, you could have some type of down on your luck and then you start taking action and then wake up too. So really, I just think you just put in the action, really learn your knowledge, and then as it comes, we'll be fine.
That's
right. And you don't have to rely on corrupt institutions to tell you what you can and can't do, what you can and can't think, where you can and can't go. You can make that decision yourself. You don't have to rely on some father figure mentality to do that for you and relinquish your responsibility, relinquish your decision-making to somebody else to keep you safe from an enemy that they've created. They're the ones that you're really subconsciously afraid of. You need to stand up against that, take responsibility for your life, your family, yourself, your own actions, and be something real instead of being another brick in the wall, another corporate drone just listening and doing what everybody else does.
Okay, Dan, you have 30 seconds. Anything?
Well, what I would have to say is that pretty much everyone who's listening into our program is awake to some point, if not fully awake. And people need to realize that the time for armchair activism is over. It's time for us to get out into the streets and demand that things change and force the system to change. We can beg and beg and beg and beg and ask for permission and ask them to change things, but that's not going to do one iota. We need to get out and declare our sovereignty and take these actions and make them atone for the crimes that they've committed and create a new paradigm shift and work together to set up a new republic.
Exactly. Now, if you want to work with the Republic, just write to republicofcanada@gmail.com. In London, it's, again, your email, Dan?
LondonDirectActionGroup@gmail.com.
Right. And also follow work, of course, CanadaRepublic.ca. We're here every Sunday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, 11 p.m. in England. And we look forward next week to our brothers and sisters across the water joining us for this continuing struggle. I want to thank you all. And until next week, stay clear and stay strong. Thank you all.